Aha! Good evening, everybody, and welcome to our regular Wednesday stream. I was going to try and start this with the Sopranos theme, but we would get copyright struck to the moon and back. They would
Yeah.
actually destroy us.
I
We
mean,
would
we could
die.
try and do a sort of rendition of it, but I'd rather do people's eardrums, not do them the disservice.
Woke up this
Moon.
morning, got yourself a gun.
Billy. Well,
We'd
and of
have to do
course,
two versions of it though to wipe out the Twin Towers and the later ones.
was gonna say, yeah, you have to have them edited out. In fact, my fiance, she lives in Connecticut and several times has done the exact drive from New York into New Jersey.
She done the Sopranos drive.
Yeah, it is. Yeah, it's New York into New Jersey, isn't it? That's right.
New Jersey. You
New
was just saying it
Jersey,
wrong. It's
yeah.
New Jersey.
New Jersey. Hey, Tom, come on.
Christopher. No, we'll not degrade. We'll
We're
not
try
compete.
we'll try not to just descend into bad Italian American impressions.
Absolutely zero promises on that front, I'm afraid.
Well, as you mentioned off air, for those who don't know where the Heath Dolan references come from, that's the Sopranos, and that's why we always talk about Tony Blair as Don, because he is unfortunately our Medici.
I would actually say, I mean, I don't want to drive away any potential viewers, but this will contain probably some quite heavy spoilers for the show if you haven't seen it.
There'll be
You have been warned.
some. A lot of them are like cultural points. If you were around at the time, you will have hit though.
Yeah, you'll have heard of them. Yeah, and also I think most people are at least familiar enough with it to know what we're talking
Yeah, and
about.
if you've not
So.
watched it by now, where you been? It's like, oh no, but it's like doing spoilers for Who Shot Mr. Burns, you know?
Yeah,
Well, no,
exactly.
it's oh yeah, spoilers. Germany lost. No, but to do even more
Did they
fourth wall
really?
breaking, like any time we're doing Nomos stuff or have met up for any reason, a
Yeah.
large amount of our conversation between ourselves and Mr. Hat generally happens in a kind of faux Sopranos like form,
We
and
always start talking
we have
about it.
discussed on a number of occasions that like at some point we're going to have to look at Tony Soprano as a sort of reactionary last patriarch character, so
Yes,
we are here
absolutely.
eventually.
Well, for those who don't know, do you want to quickly introduce yourself there, Mr. Panama Hat?
What do you mean for those that don't know?
Yeah, well, I mean, I'm pretty sure all the viewers of the channel know me by now, but I'm Panama Hat. I live behind a desk in Wales, and I write a lot of different things. I have a YouTube channel which I haven't uploaded to for far too long, but as I keep promising, there is a video soon. I've worked on several of them consecutively, which is makes things very slow, but at least two of them are nearly ready to go, and they're
Well,
quite substantial.
I would heavily recommend people go check your backlog anyway. I know
Yes.
your Yukio Mishima video was a fantastic one.
Thank
It was
you.
rather good,
Yes.
yes. So all the links are down below for Mr. Panama Hat. And if you do
Yep.
want to see him live, he will be helping us host our Nomos event on the 27th of May this
Yes,
year.
indeed.
If you are in the UK and you can come see us live doing live things. So
It's
if you
very
enjoy
worth
this
it.
level of banter, you can come join us on the 27th of May. We've already got a couple of good donations as well, reminding us that we are still monetized. If you do want to not pay the YouTube tax, the best way to do that is just direct through PayPal. Thank you for the anonymous $50 donation that just said consulting on it and the comment was based. You know who you are, so thank you very much for that.
Based on what?
But yeah,
Sorry,
based on
that's
what?
X Files. That's for when we do a
Yeah. Based
different.
on what, Mulder? We've actually found a way, I think, to also just sneak in pop culture criticism. But like I said, if you do want to throw us some money and interact with the video, that does help us a lot, because it basically means that YouTube thinks we're not shite.
I also just want to put in an extra shill for Nomos. It's worth going. It's even worth going to Manchester for.
Yes, it
It's
is.
absolutely worth
It's
it.
one of the very few things that you could actually make Manchester a worthwhile destination for anybody.
I mean, I've never actually been to Manchester before. This is a first for me, and I managed to find an Airbnb which is right in the middle of the town and is looking over the river. So I will get the privilege of standing in the glass at night, you know, with a sort of whiskey in hand.
We might be an Airbnb's and basically the same bit then.
We'll be in a similar bit, it seems. But
I mean, it's within 10 minutes of the Oxford Road.
We'll need to go take a quick visit to Aston's tobacconists on the Friday as well.
Yes, we will. I'm currently sitting
with some Peterson Sunset Breeze that I got from there on Saturday in the old Falcon pipe. That's rather good.
But Evelyn, do you wanna before you spark up again? Do you wanna quickly
spark
read
up
this first donation here from Coney current year?
Do I have to do the accent?
You do, yes.
All right.
It's compulsory. Yeah.
You discovered the virus. Is what he did. He was a brave Italian doctor, and in this house, Anthony Fauci is a hero. End of story.
That's, of course, from the famous Sopranos quote about Christopher Columbus.
Not so many people have some good things to say about Christopher Columbus.
Yeah, I thought a lot of people are not so happy for Columbus. I hated the North.
But another £5 there from Coney Current. Said, hey, don't. No disrespect. What about the World Trade Center 7th building? What about that tower they don't want you to talk about?
You're telling me a building fell into its own footprint?
I'm telling you, Tony, it's the
jet fuel.
He's not going to melt them beams, Tone.
Oh!
Oh, dear. Well, we're... press 7 to remember... But we call this Tony Soprano, the last patriarch. And this is weirdly part of the arc of our normal streams. This isn't just something we've done out of left field. Because the genesis of this is the fact that I'm a firm believer, and I think you're a firm believer as well, that Tony Soprano really was the last kind of television patriarch, and they had to effectively make him an anti-hero.
Mm.
I
was going to say, just very briefly, he was allowed to be a patriarch in a way that wasn't pathetic.
Yes.
He is heroic. What he does is not aim himself at, you know, meliorism or some sort of compromise. He's not political in any sort of liberal and indifferent sense. He's an absolutist.
Yes.
He's an idealist. He's only interested in glory and greatness and honour and all these things that we are not supposed to think about or be interested in any way, shape or form.
I'm just going to light this cigar, which I have in honor of Tone.
Of Mel Tono.
But the thing is, I think The Sopranos is one of the last intelligently written and directed major TV shows, full stop. I mean,
yes.
I mean, I'm not saying that David Chase is one of us. I don't think he is. But clearly he has a level of understanding and depth to his writing that is very, very rare nowadays. You know, like this is one of the best explorations, not only of, you know, the whole kind of Italian American thing, but of power in general, I think, in television and film. You know,
yes.
And I mean, that's because I only watched the show for the first time a few years ago. And I got into it because of the memes, you know. I thought it was going to be like, you know, all that kind of thing.
Well,
it was funny. I mean, that is a big part of it.
That's what makes it so great. It's both.
But I very quickly realized that it was much more. There's much more to it than that. You know, there was clearly an entire philosophy on power being expended, and of course the relationship between the fact that they're Italian also matters, because you can read stories about, you know, the Italian noble families of the 1400s, say, and, you know, all of them fighting for control over the papacy and for positions of power, and, you know, these long blood feuds, and, you know, the kind of naked power of rewarding your friends and destroying your enemies so openly, which is, you know, that's how power works. But of course you transplant that into kind of, you know, grubby early 2000s New Jersey, and it's even more fascinating in a sense, because you have a kind of climate of naked old school Italian style sort of power networks within an American framework which still uses all of those frameworks, but pretends that it's liberal and pretends that it's democratic, and you know, it has to crush the Mafia, not really for any reason other than that it's kind of a rival power network.
Yeah.
And that can't be tolerated.
I mean, the apex of almost all of it is in one of the episodes in a kind of throwaway skit almost at the end. And the Christopher Columbus Day stuff.
Yeah.
Where they've got all these, like, you know, like, crust punk university students and, like, old Native American dude, like, activists. And they're all out, like, in front of the statue. And they don't even try and have it out with them. They just, like, all roll out a couple of SUVs and just go and batter them all and blue. It's like there's no justification, no even pretenses towards, you know, we're going to threaten you with violence. You know, it's just, no, we're just going to go and do it.
Anti-Italian discrimination is what it is.
I know, and it was something I said to you sort of before the stream started, that so much of what Tony Soprano's character is can almost be read as someone trying to force their identity out so explicitly against what is the typical American negation of national identity. That they are, in the same way that, you know, like Muslims are here in Britain, they're like a separate sort of crime syndicate. Yeah. Their entire world
parallelism.
Is different.
They have a lot of parallelism there.
Well, that's one of the... It's perhaps the kind of main through line of the show is Tony's struggle for identity, really, because he doesn't really know what he is, because he clings to these separate things which are kind of contradictory. You know, on the one hand, he's a proud, you know, American patriot, you know, who loves the American way of life, whatever that is. But he's also, you know, a proud, he's the Italian, you know, we came from a Brezzo or whatever, you know, this kind of thing. And the trouble is, you can't really have both without some sort of conflict. I mean, the example you brought up there about Muslims in Britain is very apt, because, you know, on the one hand, they'll come on the sort of, you know, HSBC advert with Richard Ayoade and go on about how proud they are to be British and wave the Union Jack.
Did we lose hat there?
Oh no, we may have lost the hat.
Oh, there you go. You've come back now. Sorry, you disappeared for a second.
Am I still here?
You're still here. Yes.
But it was a bit of a blip though. But yeah, but basically, you know, in practice, they're not British or English in any way. It's what I think Norman Tebbit used to call it the cricket test, where you get these immigrants from Pakistan, for example, who claim that they're very, very pro-British, but they support the Pakistani cricket team whenever they beat England. You see, it's the conflict between the two identities.
Well, yeah, think of, you know, one of the main sort of cruxes throughout a lot of the different episodes and the way that he comes to terms with a lot of the different sort of situations he's put in is that he goes and talks to the psychologist, but the psychologist doesn't offer the solutions. If anything, the psychologist gives him the prompt he needs to realize that all this, like, American pseudoscience culture and psychologizing and all this basically Jewish nonsense. It's like, nah, I'm gonna, you know, cousin this said that, uncle this said, you know, he's always just full of, like, folk
tribal
tales
wisdom.
And, yeah, folk tales and tribal wisdom. And, you know, it's all about what this old granny said from the old country, and this is what they believe. They basically tell her to go screw herself.
There's the two points you've mentioned previously, which is he talks about it, there's still 1958 in this house. Which it really is, that is the conflict right there. And he's an Italian-American from an older version of America, which has already gone in the 1990s.
Yes, he's, very much so.
He is a man. He is actually a man against time. He's a man from the old world, who was only slightly, you know, he was only trying to integrate into an older version of America. We got a couple of donations there that are quite topical. It says, a patriarch? I've never seen the show, but this and scary memes might be enough now I consider it. Yes, I would recommend watching, but he is quite literally the head of a family in both a literal and a, like, a crime family sense. I didn't get the SpongeBob meme up. I forgot that one.
Dad, are you in the Mafia?
Are you in the Mafia? And he's got the SpongeBob. You can imagine that one. But thank you for the $5.75 there, Jacob Brown. And Time Stealer just says, hey, Tone, how come he says his daddy is black, but he sounds...
Well, I mean, all I can say in response to that is I have spent a lot of time in Spain and less time in Italy. I blend in perfectly well in those two countries. I feel very much at home, especially in Spain. So I could just go and blend in with the meds, I'm sure. I wanted to talk about the psychology point of it, because the original pitch for the show, when David Chase had the idea for it, was that it would be a kind of like Don Corleone sort of mob boss type who had a therapist, right? And he would talk to the therapist about being in the mob. And that's what the show evolved from. And all through the show, Dr. Melfi is a big part of it. And the therapy sessions he goes to, which of course he has to keep a secret because, you know, you can't let people in that you have the weakness of needing a therapist, right? Especially with all these very old school Italians who would see that as, you know, really quite pathetic to have a therapist, you know.
More like Dr. Milfy.
I was going to say a lot of people say the whole part
at one point is like they're sitting in the Bada Bing and like Tony's away and they're all like, so you heard, you know, they're all talking about how Tony's got like a therapist and this, yeah. And they're basically all like the same
shrink.
Yeah, it's the same moment. They're all like, you know, one, what the hell's wrong with them? Two, is he telling her like what we're up to? But yeah, then exactly. Also at the same time, I've got that meme of Tony Soprano in my head.
There we go.
Yeah, what happened to the strong silent type?
Yeah, the strong silent type one is it. Yeah.
Now it's that face with no GF this.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
E dating that. Strong silent incel. But yeah. I mean, she is actually a very well-written and well-acted character. I don't remember the actress's name, but she, of course, is the wife in Goodfellas.
Yes.
I think she was chosen partly for that reason. She auditioned for Carmela, Tony's wife, originally, but they didn't want to make the reference that overt. So they made her the therapist instead. And of course, I think that there's a very clever representational trick going on because Tony begins to develop feelings for her, and she knows, according to the rules of psychology as a profession, that you shouldn't treat somebody who admits criminal activities to you, or somebody who, like Tony, appears to be sociopathic in a dangerous way, basically. She knows that she's breaking ethical rules by continuing to treat him with talking therapy, but because she's so fascinated by him, and so kind of entranced with his story and his personality, she can't let it go. And she doesn't realize it, but throughout the show, she becomes his kind of consigliere.
Yeah.
Right? Yes.
Or consigliere, I should say, who basically is giving him sound, intelligent advice on how to run his criminal empire. And it's only she only realizes it at the end. And, you know, she realizes kind of what she's done and what she's been involved in. But of course, I think she also partially represents, even though, of course, her character is meant to be ethnically Italian, she represents a kind of American liberal, somewhat upper class fascination.
Yes.
With a kind of down and dirty gangster, kind of naked power type like Tony, doesn't she? Because she literally, at points, she clearly has a kind of almost lust for him. And she.
Oh,
she,
definitely.
You can see how she wears these kind of sort of sexy office outfits whenever she has an appointment with him. You can see the difference between when she's in an appointment with him and when she isn't. How she's dressed, you know. There's clearly this morbid fascination with the mob that I think America has, because, and if my personal opinion is, it's because the mob and the mafia not only attempt to remain true to their original ethnic identity, but they're not afraid of flaunting open power.
Well,
you know, they don't play along with the liberal game of the United States as a whole that most people know isn't true anyway.
Yeah, well, you said you sort of this down and dirty character, but I think that's almost a very clever, dare I say it, juxtaposition that they're playing.
Yeah.
Because ultimately the character that he is, if he was in any other period of time, would be an aristocrat.
Yes.
He has multiple women, he's got all these cars and all this money and this business enterprise, and he's engaging in crime and basically getting away with it because he's got dirt on everyone. It's like, you know, that he's played to us as if he is scum, but in a sense we have to recognize that he's like something above and beyond us because he has power that most people will just never ever come close to.
He's a great study on like sovereignty as well. Within his world, within his area, he is effectively sovereign.
Mm.
And when he goes to the other families, it's like weird international relations. And it has some good stuff about the loneliness of power, I know you mentioned, you know, in the a little bit off air about the kind of the illusion of democracy aspect, and that he is in a shrinking world, but in a previous time, the mob really filled a hole. They were to most people who were in those areas, a necessary evil in many senses. They were a force of order.
I mean, in Italy, during the Mezzogiorno, which is brought up several times on the show as a kind of excuse for this type of behavior, is that the police and the government of Italy at the time were more corrupt than the mafia was.
Yes. Yeah.
That you would be far more likely to trust the local don than you would the local mayor or police officers, because their crookedness was less apparent, basically.
Yeah, the term mafia is... it's derived from an Arabic term, mafus, which basically means like scammer. And it originates from sort of Arabs trading with folk from the Italian islands who were, you know, growing citrus fruits or olive oil or wine or whatever it was. And because they grew the best stuff, they sold a higher price for it. And this in part came to them being just sort of they're just shysters and scammers because to some extent, the Arabs didn't appreciate the quality of the goods and stuff they were buying, so they thought, we'll just buy it from somebody else.
The eternal Italian.
But it sort of goes further and further than that, because what happens is you end up with these, you know, independent islands and these coastal regions of Italy that become very, very powerful in their own right. And they become powerful in their own right through, like, trading families, and then also the families who protected, insured, and managed a lot of the land, orange sort of groves or vines for wine or olive oil or whatever it was. And this constantly builds and builds and builds, and you have consolidations of these families and these networks right up until about nearly the turn of the century in the 1900s. And all of a sudden the Italian government just decides to basically step in and rid every single aspect of trade across all these different regions of mafia quote-unquote connections, which... If you'd asked someone in Italy at the time, you know, 1890 something, you're like, what's the mafia? They're like, what?
Yeah.
Well, because it was just how it worked.
That brings me on to the first little, I don't have a clip for this, but the first little vignette I want to talk about before we talk about some of the ones that you got, which I think are great, because I got some clips for the stuff that you linked me off air too. There's the bit where they're basically extorting a Jewish hotel owner that's being very stubborn.
So the conceit is that there's a Jewish hotel owner who is having trouble with his son, who I think wants to marry an unsuitable woman. And by the way, the way that the show handles Jews is very interesting, because they're portrayed as a more successful in-group and a more vicious in-group. This Jewish hotel owner is willing to ruin his son financially for marrying outside the tribe, is how I remember it. Anyway, I haven't seen that particular episode for a bit, but he basically says to Tony, do whatever you can to stop my son from doing this and I will reward you. And there's a fantastic scene where, because there are these sort of two old Jewish men in the suits and the hats and everything, and his friend grabs him by the jacket and he says, I think in Hebrew, because don't you see what you're doing? You're creating a golem. of course, what happens is, you know, Tony does quite literally become a golem, because once he's finished with the lower level guy, he's a mob boss. He takes advantage of weakness and he eventually screws the older Jewish guy over, because, you know, he's playing a power game.
Well, there's a whole thing where this guy goes on a monologue about Israel and Jerusalem being destroyed by the Romans.
It's like the 77 Jews that protected some castle against a million Roman soldiers. Or is it 6 million Roman soldiers, however many it was again.
and he's going, and the Romans, where are they now? And Tony's just there with
looking at him, asshole.
You're looking at him, asshole, which is where that meme comes from. It's such a good moment.
Fantastic. It's a really good moment, yeah. But I mean, yeah, it's I mean, there is probably more to say on Jewishness in The Sopranos as a whole, but that is a particular standout moment to me anyway.
If I'm right in saying, numerous usage of the term Shylock as if to suggest that engaging in money lending is somehow a dirtier sort of arrangement than the things that they engage themselves with.
Yes.
But there is a lot of there's a lot of things as well like that, though, in terms of the fact that the way they also, there is almost, other than when it becomes extremely relevant to certain aspects of the plot, no reference to like low level black street crime. It's almost like it's like completely below them. They don't even exist in a world where they see it.
There's a, I mean, just one more point on the Jews, of course, is that they're not totally divorced on them because, of course, they have Hesh.
Yes,
who is a member, a very close and very, very intimate member of their circle, who is Jewish, who is basically treated as one of them and works with them as a, as basically a brother. But of course, he's useful because he's that is their foot into the sort of Jewish equivalent of their world, if you like, and you know. Power doesn't exist in a vacuum. You have to do deals with other factions and other countries, if you like, to ensure that your position is stable, right? So there's a lot of diplomacy between, you know, other Italian gangs or, you know, as I said, the Jewish world. If the show if the show is set in the '20s, like Boardwalk Empire, for example, which is a somewhat similar example, they'd be doing deals with the Polish and the Irish, etc., because, you know, You have to negotiate in order to survive. But anyway, yes, we were moving on.
I was going to say there was a super chat. Thank you, Alice Little, 1872, for the segue here, saying, didn't get beyond season 3. Is it worth going back and finishing the series beyond that? I'd say up until maybe season 5. Yeah, I wasn't the biggest fan of stuff out. Honestly, we stopped watching maybe the end of season 5, beginning of season 6, because we had our fill of it. But I'd say it's worth, and then I'd say it's worth doing it. So the arc with Meadow and a black boyfriend annoyed me, lol. You see, that's funny because the arc actually has quite a satisfying end to it.
Interesting ending, isn't it?
But
one Jamal Ginsberg.
Yeah. Well, I've got
shall we talk about that?
I've got a quick clip here I can play.
Jamal Ginsberg, right. The Hasidic homeboy.
We won't be able to hear it. It's just Tone in bed saying it. I'll play that one again.
Homeboy.
But he's like a half black, half Jewish college kid that Tony Soprano's daughter ends up going out with, and he basically gives him a hard time because he's, you know, an Italian man.
It's very interesting the dynamic between him and Meadow, and the actual character's name is Noah, but you know, Jamal is a funnier name, so I think we'll use
Jamal
that.
Ginsberg.
But Jamal Ginsberg, but which is what Tony calls him, as you heard. But he is basically a kind of, as I said, an arrogant college student who, you know, is half African American, half Jewish. And Meadow goes on dates with him, and he's her boyfriend for a bit. And they both share their kind of upper class, privileged, liberal views, which is another fantastic aspect of the show, is how David Chase lampoons this kind of liberal, left-wing sons and daughters of extremely wealthy people like Tony Soprano, or like Jamal's father, who's a kind of sort of East Coast businessman, and you know, all these types of people, you know, the kind of privileged scions of families like this. And it's hinted several times throughout the show that what Tony's doing is not a million miles away from, quote, legitimate politics and business and things, you know. But anyway, Tony basically puts his foot down and says, I'm not having my daughter date somebody of this particular ethnicity, or either of the ethnicities.
And the thing is, she reacts badly, goes out on her own. It turns out he's a complete asshole anyway. It's kind of funny. Yeah. Turns out he's actually a wrong and completely up his own ass. And it's not trying to lecture the audience, which I think is great.
Mm.
No, and also the. Unlike most media over the last 30 years, the show doesn't actually punish Tony for being conservative. It doesn't punish him for having out-of-date views. It just, you know, he's calling the shots, and he says no, basically.
One thing I think I sort of noticed when we were watching through some of it is, if anything, if he's punished for one thing, he's punished for not going hard enough.
Yeah,
there are so many occasions where he tries to be the nice guy. It's like he has the opportunity to essentially kill someone, get away with it, and it would clear up all of his problems. But he turns around and says, like, look, I'm going to give you a last chance. And you know at that moment when he does it, it's like, no, it's all going to go so wrong.
Yeah.
It's amazing that in trying to make him not cartoonish, but also make him a lot of this stuff you see with the producers, always a parody of masculinity. But really, the way they tried to balance it, they made him, apart from his slight petulance in many cases, aggressively fair in some ways. It's, if you look at his decision making in the abstract, he is an extremely good leader in many cases. He's prone to jealousy, and he does have poor decision making in some ways. But also, his like weird jealous streak makes him quite perceptive to people who are actually out to get him as well. It's interesting quite how, again, divorced from the liberal guilt aspect of it in the 90s, how good of a patriarch he actually is to his family and to his crime family as well.
Well, I mean, yes, because there's an irony to the fact that... Okay, so I actually reread Il Principe, of course, Machiavelli's Prince, earlier today. Because it's very short, of course, in preparation for this, because I think you can more or less view the show as a discourse on Machiavelli. You know, there's even that great scene where Paulie compares Sun Tzu as he's the Chinese Prince Machiavelli. but in that there's a section on, you know, you can be a leader who is known for being merciful, or a leader who is known for being ruthless, but you can't be in between the two. Yeah. You have to stick to your guns once you're one or the other. And Tony's problem, as you said, is that he's constantly flitting between the two, and he doesn't really have the heart to commit to being the ruthless gangster that he would be a more effective... You know, I think he would easily have had a more successful run at being a mob boss had he stuck to, you know, a ruthlessness, or from the beginning... You know, taking a different approach, but as Prince Machiavelli says, you can't flip between the two. So
there's some great stuff about people like not just not knowing how certain words are said as a joke, and it's like there's the whole Nietzsche thing where he's thinking about Nietzsche and existentialism. Yeah. Tony Jr.
You just revealed your own ignorance.
I just revealed my own what?
Also, we have the gabagool in the top corner there, in case people were wondering what the weird fatty meat is. That is the gabagool. There's a lot of memes about the gabagool. It's just, you like to think it's some kind of ghoul who plays Gabba.
No, but... I think of it more as like, you know, if you were to go into some sort of like mafia internal like esoteric seance where they resurrect the spirit of some, you know, ancient Don who should be the consigliere of this precise moment, and they raise the gabagools.
Yes.
Yeah, well, I actually, a while ago, I looked into what exactly it is, and apparently it's a type of smoked meat from northern Italy,
It's capricol. You can get it over here.
Yeah, but I love the degeneration from capicola to capicol to gabagool.
Yeah.
as you cross the Atlantic.
It's basically like Neapolitan American transplants. It's borderline Whoppy Bonics is what gabagool is.
Well, okay, I want to make two. So I just want to make one more point in relation to Jamal Ginsberg, because there's a line from Tony which is very, very interesting, and interesting that they were able to get away with it. I don't think they would now. But he basically says, he says something along the lines of, "I don't have anything against the blacks. They wouldn't want one of mine marrying their daughters. I don't want one of them marrying my daughters." It's that kind of old-fashioned, what I would call laissez-faire self-segregation, right? Mm. They do their thing, we do our thing, so is so, you know?
Italians marry Italians, ducks marry ducks, geese marry geese, that kind of thing.
Exactly, yeah. The, you know, you have to maintain the basic, you know, ethnos, for want of another word, of your tribe, right? You can't just lose the purity. I mean, you know, the whole thing about... purity of blood in med cultures is a huge thing, ironically.
Yes, it is.
But yeah, and that didn't go away. And as he says, you know, they keep to theirs, we'll keep to ours, and there's no need to mix the two.
I gotta say, just a quick point on the El Duce image we have, which is a great composite. That's one we actually made for a stream with Lua Lavoie, which shows you how far back the idea for this stream actually goes.
I think that's maybe one of mine, possibly.
No, it's not.
That one?
I made that one.
Fair enough.
It blends really well. It was actually a bit of work, but no, I did make that one. Sorry, go on. That's just a quick aside.
I think what the other point was going to be. We were talking about... Oh, yes, that was right. The thing about the... It's quite sad, actually, because he talks about... You know, they all talk about Italy and the old country. And they have this really romantic view of life in Italy and the fact that they all came from kind of humble peasant origins. And, you know, he takes Meadow to that church and says, you know, your great-grandfathers arrived here with nothing and they built this church and, you know, they worked themselves up and everything. Kind of tying into the American myth by default. And then, of course, they realize, well, they don't realize it themselves, but the show points out that they actually, by this point, have very, very little connection to anything authentically Italian.
Yeah.
Or any...
You've disappeared again.
Always
for a second.
In an Italian... Go, oh,
it's fine.
Am I back?
We're okay. It was just for a second.
Paulie goes to Italy and orders gravy with his spaghetti. You know, and the Italian waiter is offended beyond words at this. You know, things like that. Or the fact that they don't really understand any of the Italian that's being spoken to them. And there's a bit where Furio, who's, you know, a kind of real from the streets of Italy, you know, Italian gangster, is about to basically shoot a child for letting off some firecrackers near them. And, you know, Tony and the gang are basically really shocked by this. You know, they're like, you know, you'd hurt a kid and it's like, you know, that's the actual Italian mafia for you. You know? They're a lot more ruthless than in New Jersey.
Isn't one of the episodes... It's either one of the episodes or stretches across two of them where he's in Italy briefly.
Yes, it is. He's with a female mob boss.
Yeah, and he gets towards the end of it and he's just kind of like, this place is shit.
Yeah, Italy's a fucking... He's in like Naples as well, basically. Yeah. He's in like mafia heaven in the 90s in Italy and he hates it. It's shit. He misses America. He's not Italian. It's almost...
There's no SUVs.
Yeah, it's almost like our sensible discussion on race thing. He's become so deracinated that he loves the idea of being Italian, but also loves the idea of being American, but he's neither.
Yes.
And exactly. And he hates the fact that he's neither and that his family
he's
is
He's stuck
neither.
Between the two.
Yeah. And it's presented as this, ooh, this conflict, and ooh, all these hybrid identities. But really, it just shows like what shit like assimilation is and things
exactly.
like that. It's a
exactly.
great example of that. Not to get too long on the tooth, the second one you brought up is, we'll talk about kind of the Sopranos and Tony Soprano's kind of killings in general, because he's not someone who's like an actual murderous psychopath. He's not someone who kills because he enjoys it. In fact, he seems very annoyed by it, and it does have effect on his psyche. One of the earlier best examples is his fish dreams and his hatred of a big mouth Billy Bass he's given because of his murder of a close
four
confidant.
Bucks a pound.
Yeah, that's where the I'll play it for the stream people here, but that's where.
Anyway, $4 a pound.
That's where that little clip comes.
Anyway,
from.
$4 a pound.
Yeah. Well, I mean, he has the. The paranoia of a good leader.
Yes.
I mean, any position, any powerful person is required to be paranoid. If you aren't paranoid, you won't succeed. That's at least what I've learned from reading the history of various powerful figures, is that paranoia is actually an advantage.
Mm.
And because Tony is threatened, because remember, in the hierarchy of this, if you're a mafia boss and you lose the game, you're either looking at prison for the rest of your life, or you're looking at death, and your family will be stripped of everything they have and probably end up in poverty. You know, the stakes are very, very high. And because of that, he's always worried about his friends ratting out. And of course, you know, by the time of the late 90s, all of the big mafia operations in America had more or less wrapped up, except for the biggest one, which is, of course, Washington. the FBI and the various intelligence agencies had gotten very good at infiltrating mafias and breaking down their inner structures and drawing out the people that the Dons relied on for support into basically somewhat cushy deals. You know, I mean, I'm sure people in the chat have seen Goodfellas, where he basically rats on all his friends and goes to live in some awful, you know, new build house out in Arizona or something for the rest of his life, you know, because his only other option is prison or death. It's that. So, you know, there he kills a lot of his close associates or allows them to die in some cases because he's too scared of losing the game.
Well, yeah.
And you can see it just start to destroy him as the show goes on, basically. That he, you know, I mean, we mentioned, of course, one of his closest, oldest friends is Big Pussy, who he has to execute, basically, because he was discovered to have been ratting or had been wearing a wire because the FBI had got to him.
Yeah, he got caught with what would be called weight,
yes.
Didn't he?
And then he ends up wearing a wire.
Yes, he does. And he ends up wearing a weight in the bay, basically.
I was going to say, though, I think one of the most sort of genuinely, you know, you could say almost evil things I think he does is his treatment of Uncle Jun. And purely for, you know, like, he only ever seems to engage in that level of evil because he feels it's better for the family and the wider sort of scope of it. That basically keeping Uncle Jun locked up in his house as he has like dementia and starts to slowly lose his mind. And he just has these meetings with him sort of every once in a while that makes him pretend that Jun's really running the show.
I don't know if it's evil per se, because I would say in some ways Uncle Jun is a bigger scumbag than Tony.
Oh, he's by no means a good guy, but I think he's very much someone who's a mentor to him. He's someone that, you know, has probably, you could imagine, kind of put his neck out there for Tony's sake. And then Tony
he's also
basically
a lot less competent.
Yes,
he is. He's not very good. He's somebody who thinks he should be put in charge because it's his turn rather than him being the best person for the job.
He's stuck around for long enough.
But that's kind of how that world works, though, I would imagine. And the fact that Tony basically just completely sweeps up Major Control out from under his feet and then keeps them sort of in complete confusion about it to the point whereby his dementia basically just makes him useless anyway. And then he goes missing and walking around different bits of New Jersey and all sorts of stuff.
The thing is with Uncle Jun is, who is Tony's uncle, he is somebody who has been in the mafia. He is somebody who tries to be ruthless, but he's also a doddering old man.
Mm.
And I think the series does a great job of portraying Jun and how bitter and then in the end just confused he is by his situation. It's quite sad. I do, despite him being not a particularly nice person, he's too bumbling. He's never allowed to have his evil plans come to fruition anyway.
To be fair,
just an old man in a house.
He did also try and kill Tony at one point, as does Tony's mum as well.
Yes, that's correct.
I wanted to get onto this because I think one of the smartest things Tony does in the entire run, maybe even the most intelligent move we see him play, is that after the nominal boss of the family, which is Carmine Sr., isn't it?
Yes.
Or is it? Yeah. After he dies of cancer unexpectedly, of course, that it's generally assumed that Uncle Jun would be the next Don by seniority, as we said. But of course, everyone knows by now that Tony is the real big fish in the pond. And Tony is able to manipulate Uncle Jun into being the titular head of the family, thus drawing all the heat of the cops and the FBI onto him, while everyone knows that Tony is really in charge. So it's sort of like a puppet king. And, you know, as Prince Machiavelli says, you know, sometimes it's better to be the ideal position is to be powerful but hidden, as opposed to powerful and out there, because it draws a lot of heat away from you, you know. So Tony becomes the kind of eminence gris of the crime family because he's hiding behind Uncle Jun as a figurehead, basically an essentially powerless puppet king.
It also means he's
a very, very smart move.
He's also essentially responsible for his house arrest though as well.
Mm.
It's him. Yeah. It's kind of June's the one in the perpetual legal trouble, as they've been doing to all the other heads of the families. That's kind of how they broke them. Is that they were just, even if they were never found guilty of anything, they were just perpetually in court for a decade as they became older and older men. In fact, they talk about that.
Yeah.
They talk about basically how the US government uses the legal system to attack rival power centers through unceasing litigation.
Yes.
They'll just bankrupt you with lawyers.
Yeah. It's such a headache for them. And it's, even though he is never really found guilty in the end, you know, there's mistrial and it just drags on and on and on and on and on and on and on, but they can just put you through legal hell. And that's really what he's going through. He effectively is already in prison the moment they decide they want to try and prosecute him, or the moment they decide that he's someone who's not too dangerous for them to go after. It's a great dynamic, and it's one that, if it wasn't there, the show would not be the same.
No.
It definitely wouldn't be.
I mean, it also just reinforces... I mean, so one of the grander aspects of the show that's often missed is how powerless Tony and his crime family actually are. I mean, there's a bit towards the end of the show where I think Johnny Sack of New York describe, or maybe Phil Leotardo describes Tony Soprano's whole operation as a glorified crew from New Jersey. You know, it's like these couple of small time crooks from New Jersey that think they're this major crime operation. You know, it's kind of a hilarious irony as you go on that there's all of this, you know, extremely complex power patronage and kind of feudal networking and all this kind of thing to basically sustain a criminal empire worth at most a few million.
Yeah, it is.
It's really not that big of a deal.
Or them scratching around and being the remnants. I think as well, the New York people, it's implied that everyone's operations like that.
Yeah.
That's the whole thing, that these guys are talking shit about each other, but it's really implied that the entire mafia is now like this, that they are effectively scratching around for scraps in a world that, you know, is in the gaps.
Well, and there's that fantastic scene, one of my favorite scenes in the whole show, where Patsy and another one of the kind of mid-level mobsters, they go out to this new development somewhere in New Jersey or an old street that's been redeveloped, and they go into basically a Starbucks, right, that's just opened, and they walk up to the manager, and they basically, you know, they pull out the whole thing about, oh, you need to pay us protection money and we'll smash the shop and torture you if you don't. And the manager just, he's like this like black guy who just looks at them and goes, listen, this place is a chain. Every coffee bean that comes in here gets counted through that till. If you smash up the shop, they'll just put new windows in. If you kill me, they'll just replace me. If one penny is unaccounted for at the end of the day, I'm fired. Like, what do you want me to do? And then of course, the two mobsters kind of realize that there's not a lot. They can't really extort this business. And they walk outside and go, there's no room for the little guy anymore.
Well, yeah, no, it's in and of itself, like, this beautiful little bit of commentary on the fact that there's no such thing as, like, the business little guy anymore.
No.
And as soon as you have no longer the business little guy, you can't have, like, the guy in the middle who...
Exactly.
Takes advantage of them. So the whole operation falls in the face of, like, mass consumer capitalism.
Is Starbucks is more powerful than the mob because it's bigger than the mob, because it's more ruthless than the mob.
Yeah.
And exploits people harder than the mob.
They can afford to replace everything. It's all fungible. Doesn't matter what the mob do.
We buy coffee beans from slave operations. What are you talking about?
Exactly.
Starbucks is unironically more evil than the New Jersey mob. It's a shame they couldn't extort them.
They couldn't. Well, because it's like the guy says, you can literally kill me just to get me to give you money. It won't matter. You can kill me or Starbucks will fire me. That's the only two things that can happen in this situation. You know,
it's a great bit. I agree. It's such a good bit. They're coming into, like, the new America, kind of the 2000s America, the infinite strip mall, I think, as we described it.
Mm.
Yeah.
And they're just finding that it's... Not only do the old evils not work, but nothing from the old world is interoperable there. It is the death of the old world, really. Mm. And that's a signifier.
It doesn't function.
Yeah. You can't even extort people.
And there's some moments as well whereby, in that same sense, even the things that should work, the sort of power he wields locally, doesn't end up working or gets diffused because people are just so detached from a world that would work like that.
Well, speaking of kind of individual businesses We can talk briefly about his, I guess, somewhat friendship with Artie and his the blowing up of Artie's restaurant.
Scientist baffled at man's ability to fuck up every single time.
Yes.
Artie Bucco. Poor old Artie Bucco. So, for anyone who doesn't know, Artie is... his name is Arthur, but he's called Artie. Is a chef and a restaurant owner in the locality, who is it's implied, I think they're old school friends. Him and Artie, they go back a long way. But Artie isn't involved in any mafia activity. He's a legitimate businessman who tries his hardest to run a restaurant, which is implied is barely getting by.
Yeah.
Despite the fact that he is actually a very, very good cook. You know, it's just America now. You know, I mean, it's pretty difficult to run a restaurant even in good times.
He's running an independent restaurant in New Jersey in the night, in like the late 90s. He's fucked.
It's not great. And he also has a wife, Charmaine, who is one of these characters who the things she says are completely correct, but she's extremely annoying and a bit of a harridan.
Yeah.
So you're not inclined to sympathize with her.
She's terrible,
but she is right ultimately in the things she's warned
right,
him about.
She's,
you know,
she's got no message crafting.
She doesn't have optics.
She's a shrew, is what
she is.
She is the
Mark Collett of the Italian American business world. No optics. But yeah, so at some point in the early show, I forget the exact intricacies of it, but Tony detonates a bomb and commits an arson attack on Artie's restaurant without telling Artie that he was behind it. And for the rest of the show, even though Artie has, you know, big suspicions that it was Tony, he is never really any the wiser for it. And I mean, to be fair, it does help him in the short term because he's able to collect a huge amount of insurance money off it and basically completely kickstart his business up over again. But to be fair, it also doesn't help that Tony and his crew eat there constantly for free and never ever pay their bar tab either. So he's losing a huge amount of money giving all these mobsters, you know, huge free meals and endless free drinks and cocktails and things.
I think it's kind of the other... I think they did that as a nod to the fact that these mobsters going... You know, they're always portrayed in movies of never paying for anything. And I think that's kind of almost like a Goodfellas nod of like what's it actually like to be the guy who has to give unlimited comp to these essentially mid-level
lobby mobsters.
The like you're talking about the scratching around New Jersey mob who's kind of barely still there.
But a lot of these really good American gangster films and shows and things always have this element where you have two characters, one of whom went into organized crime and the other one who could have but didn't. And it shows basically the pros and cons of each side, because Tony is, you know, I mean, he's not he's not that rich in the grand scheme of things, but he's very wealthy for somebody from that area of town.
Yeah.
He's very wealthy compared to what he would have been, you know. He's got a couple of million at least stashed away. He doesn't seem to struggle for money, but he's constantly paranoid. He's constantly fleeing from the law. He has to do terrible, terrible things to keep his position and his wealth. Artie is barely scraping by. He's quite miserable. He has a lot of personal issues. His restaurant could fold, but he doesn't have to worry. He doesn't have anything like the stress that Tony has.
No, from running it's kind of funny. Basically. He freaks out and he's more outwardly stressed, but really he has a lot less reason to be.
Yes. He's also warned by his wife several times that he needs to stop brushing shoulders with the mob all the time and needs to stop catering to them because it's just doing him no favors. But that's easier said than done, to be fair. So.
The last character I kind of want to talk about is Chris, because Chris is another very big part of the show.
It's called the Metaverse T.
There's a lot of Chris memes out there, but Chris is a great example. Going back to the whole Borgia...
Chris is Tony's nephew, by the way.
Yeah, going back to the whole Borgia aristocracy angle, Chris is Tony's nephew, as you said.
Yeah.
And he is meant to be kind of the next generation of the Sopranos crime family. And he's an idiot. Mm. He doesn't have the temperament for it. He's too hot-headed, but he doesn't have the Machiavellian kind of three steps ahead stuff that Tony has. He ends up as a drug addict many times. He makes silly decisions. His girlfriend, despite being quite well-meaning, is also an airhead. They're both kind of lovable goofs, but lovable goofs don't get very far in a crime family in the 90s.
Gay, Gary Cooper? Well, it's this classic problem that comes up again and again in literature or media about power, especially feudal power. The problem of choosing and finding an heir.
Yeah.
Because, of course, Tony has his younger son, AJ, who at the start of the show, he's like, what, 8, 9? And then he becomes a sort of late teen by the end of the show. He is also a complete wreck. Though, again, one of the angles of the show is that Tony, despite being this kind of big, powerful patriarch, is quite a terrible father and husband.
Yeah.
You know, he certainly has his moments, and he does love his family. But he's just appallingly bad at being father and husband, basically. You know, he's not particularly good with his kids. He constantly cheats on his wife and argues with her, you know. And there's an element to which he is basically responsible for it. But his son is a bit of a screw up. He kind of idolizes Chrissy as a potential successor or somebody who could be very competent, but Chrissy just can't live up to it. You know, he's a wreck. And it also doesn't help that Chrissy's father, I think, was killed early on in a mob war, if I'm not mistaken. And he has a lot of kind of resentment and a lot of psychological issues around that. So he's, you know, another one of these sort of off the rails, as you said, you know, drug addict, can't pull himself together, makes terrible decisions, somewhat stupid, you know?
Yeah, he is. Well, Chris's son kind of just becomes like a 90s teen or an early 2000s teen is the problem as well. Like, you see him here, he's got an earring. He basically looks like, he almost looks like Jack Black by the end of it. He's useless. He's not intelligent. He's clueless. It's not helped by his, you know, his parents effectively getting a car crash divorce through the mid seasons of The Sopranos. Well,
Tony goes through the whole thing of they're not divorcing. He'll live in a separate place and go spend basically his entire time with his guma or whatever.
Yes.
But he just refuses to. He just refuses to accept it.
I love that scene when he's talking to the psychologist and he's like, "Now me, I'm a strict Catholic. I don't believe in
divorce."
And I love when it's implied that Carmela is cheating with Furio, and he goes, "Even if my wife was having an affair with some immigrant," when he's just been going, "We're proud Italian immigrants."
Yeah,
I love the naked hypocrisy of it. It's great.
Thing is, it's played up that he's a hypocrite and he, you know, he's all these different things. But as a character, they had to make him relatable and likable.
Well, it's realistic, isn't it?
Yeah.
That's how, I mean, all of these, especially mob types who make their living by, you know, extortion and sin, and they're constantly committing adultery and all these things. I mean, a lot of, especially, you know, the Italians, obviously, they were genuinely very, very devoted to the church and to Catholicism, even while they were committing all these sins, you know. And I think some of the, especially the ones in the 20s and 30s, would donate vast sums of money for new cathedrals and statues and churches. And, you know, they would give generously to Catholic charities and things because they, you know, it's part of the duality, if we want to go down that path, of this lifestyle, isn't it? You know, that you remain loyal to an institution even as you contradict its fundamentals. But of course, you know, we were talking about the Borgias and the Medicis and all that. I mean, a lot of them were literally cardinals and priests and popes, you know, who were doing all of this stuff even while they were in the office, you know. Or they would abuse church privileges and things. You know, it's almost a Catholic tradition in and of itself, is the contradiction between being powerful and being a Christian. You know, a lot of the thought and the words of Christ are to do with the fact that a good Christian is ultimately somebody who has to rid themselves of all these things. And of course, that's what the gangsters can't do.
Yeah, I think that comes all the way back round, really, to where we started, is that Tony Soprano is allowed to be such an open and unabashed hypocrite across all mm-hmm. these different factors because he is powerful.
He is, yes. As you point out, he rewards his friends, he rewards loyalty, he punishes his enemies and protects his own. And that's how he, even though his position isn't the most glamorous compared to how the mob used to be, that's how he protects his position throughout the series. An effective patriarch is what he needs to be, and that's what he manages to be throughout it.
Well, it's worth bringing up as well the fact that he's indulged by everybody because of his power. Mm. And when he goes to see Dr. Melfi, she is too entranced with him to say no to any of this. But there's a really, really good scene where Carmela, Tony's wife, who is having issues of her own, goes to a psychologist who is this obviously Jewish guy who she goes to see. And she begins her whole sob story about, you know, oh, I love him and you know, but I feel conflicted and, oh, he's doing all these terrible things. What am I supposed to do? And the Jewish psychologist straight up just says, okay, one, I'm not taking your money because it was earned with blood. Two, if you had any moral principles, you would have divorced him years ago and left. But clearly you're so entranced by the money and the lifestyle and the respect that you can't, that you're ignoring your morals in order to remain with him. So get out of my office. it's an incredibly good moment because it's somebody who won't take the bullshit. It's somebody who says, listen, I'm not going to soothe you and blow smoke up your ass. You're either choosing to be in this or you're not. The fact is you love the lifestyle and you can't say no to it. I'm not going to sit here and treat you. Get out. It's fantastic.
It's also a great moment as well. It shows that she does not have power. Because if that was Tony, he would not have said that because he would have been mildly crapping himself.
Well, I mean, the thing is, it's in the context of the kind of psychological therapy sessions. You know, what makes those work is that as you walk in there, you kind of shed yourself of all of your other identity. It's like walking into a confession box in church.
Yes,
you know?
It is.
In that moment, you are just somebody who needs to get something off their chest, essentially.
Is there anything we've not talked about yet? I'm trying to think. I think that rounds out what we were going to say quite neatly, actually.
Is there anything else?
I don't really think so. I think we've covered a lot of the aspects of the show quite well, and a lot of the aspects of how it interacts
Someone in the chat is making a point, and I was going to make this point as well, is that for all Carmela's issues, she does actually flex power sometimes, because there is the whole thing about them basically just shoehorning Meadow into the college she wants to go to. And she does basically, whilst talking to some like professor, be like, do you know who my husband is?
She sleeps with a teacher. I think to get AJ or Meta, I can't remember which one, but to get them a preferential treatment.
I think it's Meta.
And then once the teacher has basically given them a passing grade, she leaves. She's like, okay, I've got what I needed now.
But there are moments where she's loyal to him, though. There's like all the different stuff with Furio.
Yeah,
like,
all the weird
fantasies. It's like so tonally different from the rest of the show.
It's so funny.
But it's like every time he's like, she's always doing herself up to meet Tony and Furio at the door, because Furio's just kind of hanging around as like Tony's attaché.
Yeah.
But Furio at the same, he's like doing his hair and he's making sure he's shirt collar and that's all sorted. And then he goes to the door and he just kind of sits there and they nervously talk to each other for like a few minutes. It's brilliant.
Furio he also looks like a very Italian mug in the picture.
he also looks very early 2000s with that ponytail and the leather jacket, doesn't he?
Oh, like he
does. That was the look in 2002.
He's defo's like, they hired some sort of like gig. What would be the frame? Like Gigolo to play him?
He's almost like a gigolo.
He fits that role so perfectly.
Well, I actually just want to talk about Carmela for a little bit because I've talked to several more intelligent women who have seen the show. And I've asked them because the way that the show portrays women is, dare I say it, based. Or at least based. It's a realistic depiction of female psychology I said to somebody, so in a woman in Carmela's position, who has a powerful husband and who is, you know, earning her all this wealth, but who she knows is going out there and screwing, you know, cocktail waitresses by the 12, you know, every couple of days and things. Why does she, what's basically about the incentive to put up with it when it comes to the power game among women? And they all said, well, basically, if you're Carmella, you know that there are other women who are going to compete for Tony's attention and who are going to be, you know, having sex with him. But you're the wife. You won. You secured him. Well, all of the other ones are basically flunkies who he's going to forget about in, you know, a couple of days at most. Whereas you've basically secured your position. And you can see that with a lot of the women in the show.
Yeah.
Who, as I said, are seduced by power and seduced by all of these kind of, you know, rough and tough gangsters. But they also have to play a very careful power game because they also have a ladder to climb. They have their own hierarchy as such, you know. And Carmella, you know, throws Tony out because one of his mistresses called home and had a bit of a psychological break and, you know, said all these things to her. So she kind of flew off the handle with it. But she accepts Tony back not long after, knowing that he's continuing his lifestyle of, you know, seeing endless other women.
Is it the weird, like, Bulgarian woman?
Yeah, she's like Romanian or something.
Yeah, but there's like some elements in that where, like, Tony is frustrated with her in the way that he would be, like, frustrated with, like, a cat that'd shit on the carpet.
Yeah.
It's not even like this is, like, another person that I have to deal with. It's like, oh, no, this is just, like, a thing.
Just get back in line, calm down, you know.
Yeah. She does also basically act like a child, which is, you know, kind of funny. But you're right, there's a great bit later on. What's the guy? The guy who was in The Matrix. I always like to think that this is where he's been put back in.
Oh, Cypher.
Yeah.
He's eating those simulacra steaks.
Yeah, he's eating the fake steaks. But the character he plays, who isn't particularly important in his context, he basically beats his Gumar to death, she's just a Howard Tone.
No, it's one of the women that works at the Bada Bing.
Yeah, it is. It's one of the women that works at his strip for the Bada Bing. But he gets upset about that, but he gets over it. But what upsets him more is the death of
the horse.
Pai Oh Mai.
Yeah.
Who is an equivalent of what he did to Artie's restaurant. Basically, the horse gets killed for insurance reasons. But Tony's kind of a beautiful creature.
He's got the painting in that.
My personal take is that Ralphie actually didn't kill the horse because everything points to him, but I don't think he really did because he was too much of a show off and a braggart to have just done it and then acted like you know nothing was happening. It did this is a very kind of like it's to do with a specific set of episodes. I won't go too deep into it, but I personally don't think he did. But I love as you said the fact that Ralphie is this complete and utter psychopath. Who doesn't think anything of killing and torturing people and animals, and he murders a pregnant stripper, and Tony is kind of mildly upset. And as you said, Ralphie may have killed Tony's racehorse.
He's upset that he killed he disrespected the Bing.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Is what he says.
And he has extra work to do because he has to cover up the murder to make sure the feds don't get in on it. You know, like it's just an inconvenience to him. It's not a human life. It's just another thing to hide. And of course, he kills the race. Well, he's supposed to have killed the racehorse, and Tony goes in there and beats him to death over the horse. You know?
Well, this
is a beautiful innocent creature.
I thought Ralphie was the one that gets shot by Tony's sister.
No,
is that the other nutter?
That's the other nutter.
Am I misremembering, or are they both called? They're not both called. No, that's Richie.
Richie, Ralph, with his ugly sister,
Ralph is the one who tells the fat joke about Johnny Sack's wife and gets them all into trouble over that.
That is true. That is. But we are getting into the deep lore though, so I might I might call an end to this before we get into complete whoppery.
I do love all the memes though about when they all run out to the car park and there's Ralphie stood over the body of a dead pregnant woman. And his excuse is like, okay, first of all, that wasn't my kid she was carrying. Second, she was a whore.
just a whore, Tone. She was a whore.
I got a list of excuses for this. Yeah.
Well, if you guys do want to find Mr. Panama Hat, you can find his YouTube channel in the chat. He's also linked in the description. There will be more coming. He's also on the Twitters, although we don't know how long the Twitters will be around.
No.
As I mentioned earlier, if you do want to come see us, we are doing a Nomos event on the 27th of May.
Tickets are selling rather quickly because a certain agent from Academia that we announced speaking there last week. So if you are sitting there twiddling your thumbs about thinking about whether or not to buy a ticket when payday comes on Friday, I would rather than wouldn't, because by about 2 weeks after payday, I would be very surprised if there was any left.
Do interact with the video. Do drop your like, subscribe, all that, you know, terrible YouTube-y stuff you're forced to do because of, you know, the system's there. But it does help. Like I said, we are still monetized. The best way to support us on a recurring basis is to become a member. And the best way to support us in terms of not getting it stolen by a big tech platform is to just through the PayPal at the moment, because I can't seem to get anything else working.
I think, as I keep mentioning it, but every time I mention it, someone seems to support us. So you can support us on Substack, as some people have chosen to do. I can't remember exactly how it works, but there's essentially like the equivalent of a gift function on that. And a very generous individual, one Mr. S, gave us $100 through it the other day. And he seems to be one of the very few people that's read my propaganda speech. So whoever you are, Mr. S, props to you.
We'll just finish on another bit. Well, I'm sure Mr. Hat might have a few things to shill as well. But another £5 super chat here from Coney Current Year, saying the Tony-AJ relationship was one of the most fascinating aspects of the show. Sorry. Mob boss, Italian-American dad meets early 2000s parenting. There was a lot of, I know it seems twee to talk about it now, there was a lot of good kind of cultural juxtaposition in there, done competently, which is something that modern media simply cannot do at all.
They can't get it. They don't understand any of the dynamics between, you know, like a Zoomer now and a millennial or older dad, you know. There was a film that came out a few years ago. I hated it. It was called it was by that Rian Johnson guy. It was like a crime film with Daniel Craig in it. I can't remember what it was. Knives Out, I think it was called. That's right. Knives Out. And there's a bit in that where there's like an older sister who's in, like, you know, like about to go to college or whatever, and like her younger brother. And the sister is like woke and the brother is like a Ben Shapiro watcher. And there's a bit where they start arguing, and the cringe is unreal, because he goes to her and says SJW, and she goes alt-right troll.
Terrible.
It's like, no one talks like that. This is just some boomer who's read a couple of like New York Times articles who thinks that's how kids talk to each other now. But anyway, the point at hand is that the as you said, the parenting and all the stuff, the early 2000s, kind of what for us would have been Blair era, for them was sort of late sort of Clinton hangover stuff with you know, like No Child Left Behind and all the stuff about self-esteem, which is a completely worthless concept, and all this kind of thing, and it's handled extremely well. I was going to say as well, do you think at some point we should do a part two where we talk more about Tony's family and his kind of intimate relationships as opposed to his kind of mob power?
I think we could, and possibly we'll just engage in a bit more research prior to...
Yeah, but right, I think right. There's so much to say about Soprano, Tony Soprano as a patriarch. It might be good to have a follow-up at some point, but that might be a little bit far in the future. You should see our list of topics. It's insane. We have a lot of stuff we need to cover. Before we go off air, is there anything else that you'd like to show?
No, not really. I'm involved with something Nathan Hood is setting up called Wagner Day, where we're going to do a bunch of streams and videos on Richard Wagner, in the same way that we did Carlisle and Evola back in 2021. But I can't say too much on that. I'm going to be talking about Wagner's total art, where he kind of combines, you know, poetry and music and the stage and all that in a particular way. I don't know whether that's going to be a video on my channel or a live stream yet, though, because the planning is still open.
As if you let me shill on your behalf, I would recommend that people go watch the stream with you did with us the other week on poetry stuff, which yes. has subsequently got a bit more of a positive reception recently. So a lot of people did ask for it. So go watch it. Go send it over 1,000 views so it's not there dying, unlike the rest of our
stuff.
Yeah,
I'll link that in the chat as like the last thing. But there is another stream we did a month ago with Mr. Panama Hat. A beginner's guide to English poetry, which I thought was a lovely stream. I enjoyed doing it.
Mm-hmm.
But unfortunately, it seems if you mention poetry, the algorithm kills you. it's not like a lot of people actually had to seek that stream out. So
whatever ancient demon that's chained up under the Google headquarters that powers this platform, they just they have to suppress any vital life forces.
It absolutely detests verse.
Yes,
it won't have it.
Just one last thing. Thank you, Melon, for the $5. God, the incoming. Yeah, the online safety bill's a bitch. Online safety bill's a bitch, and it will start affecting random things like that. But that brings me on to the point of thank you, everyone who donated. You've been very generous this stream.
Mm-hmm.
Thank you to all of our members. Thank you to all of you who have been supporting us over on Substack. Thank you to everyone who has just generally been watching and interacting. It's usually extremely drama free, so it's very good to. I don't know where. We're such a beautiful audience.
Your mom is so lovely tonight.
Thank you guys very much for coming and have yourselves a good night.
Good night.